From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special Christmas edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Merry Christmas, everybody.
This is Merry Christmas. Christmas. Merry Christmas, you filthy animal.
Yeah, so we're being cowboys at Christmas. We're doing a Christmas Western. But before we do that, by the way, I'm joined by Mr. John Grace in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And joining us from his palatial suite at the Cecil Hotel, we've got Mr. Eric Zaldivar.
What up?
What up? So before we go into our movie, real quick, we're going to whip out our junk?
Sure.
All right. John, you want to go first?
Sure. Actually got this a few weeks ago, but finally pulled it out of a stack and was organizing things. Terry and the Pirates. I don't know if you can see this.
Ooh.
Huge hardcover. Nice. Collection of the newspaper strips. I got this from at a comic book convention a couple of weeks ago, visiting Mike Barron, and across his from his table was a comic historian, R.C. Harvey, who I didn't realize who he was until after I bought this. But I was up on his at his table looking at this at the book because he had it for sale, and he just walks up to me and goes, "That'll be $3. It's right by that bit." I was like, "Are you sure?" Like I didn't believe it, but I was like, okay. And then I picked some other stuff. I didn't bring that to the stack to show off, but maybe next week. But I ended up getting a great deal on those for like $3 each, and I took them over to put them behind Mike Barron's table so I could look around the convention a little bit. And Mike's like, "How much did you pay for those?" I went $3 each, and he was like stunned because I guess he'd been across the aisle from RC like an entire day or two and didn't even notice that. And then I realized when I got home who RC Harvey was. He's this noted comic strip historian who works for these various companies, but it's a Hermes Press reprint. It's goes for like $50, I think, online, like $40, even used, it's like $50. So it's
from
like
what year to what year?
This is it's volume 2, so it's 1948 to 1949.
Okay, so it's a year. Yeah. No, all right, yeah.
Yeah, and it's that Hermes Press, overpriced. You know, they do like low print runs on these. I think they just aim them at boomers. And unfortunately, they have the rights to the Phantom right now. So the Phantom strip collections, I've managed to come by a few, but they're very unaffordable. They retail for like $50-$60, like right out the gate. But
I have a Dick Tracy one that was $30. They're not cheap.
Yeah, it's terrible how they do this. Like, and they're totally aimed at a certain collector audience because people our age are not supposed to be into this, apparently. But I'm a huge Milton Caniff fan, and so I have all the what's the other one he did, the pilot. Can't remember his damn name, but I have those collections as well. But Terry the Pirates is the one that they were always trying to make movies out of. Stallone was trying to do it with Ridley Scott at one point. It's probably the biggest influence on the Enter the Dragon production design, which has no actual authentic Hong Kong influence. It was the production designers just looked at Terry of the Pirate strips and came up with the sets. So it's pretty cool. Pretty cool to have. That's my junk for this week. Steve Canyon. That's the name of that strip I'm trying to think of with the jet pilot.
All right, Eric, you got anything?
Now, this segment is turning me into a hopeless consumer with two O's. I decided not to participate this week.
It's very, very principled of you.
Yes. It's a matter of principle.
So for me,
which is going to go get into the, well, anyways, that's esoteric. Moving on. Go ahead.
We're going to work that into jokes later
on. Yeah. Like it's
principle.
Well, so for me, my birthday haul continues. I got a few more things for my birthday. One of them is a future Beatty cast subject. Reds.
Oh, already. God.
Oh, no. You actually sat through that?
I sat through it. You know, it's one of those Warren Beatty productions that is big and obsessive, and it's about a subject I hate, and that's why I enjoy it, you know?
And let me guess, throughout the film, he's strangely charismatic yet aloof the whole time.
Boom. And Jack Nicholson plays Eugene O'Neill.
Surprising.
And he's, you know, an admirable a-hole.
Right.
You know, you got Diane Keaton. It's got music by Stephen Sondheim, R.I.P. It's actually a secret Stephen Sondheim musical, much like Dick Tracy. So, you know,
I'll never know if you're pulling our leg or not, because I've never.
I'm not. It's true. His name's in the credits.
Jeez.
You won't be able to read it if I pull it up. Just take my word for it.
Okay. Google it. Okay, I'll take your word.
Okay, this next one.
Secretary and the Pirates.
Shampoo is next. Shampoo.
This next one is probably a bad movie. I don't know. I remember it was very hyped, and then nobody went to see it. And it's also the movie that where David Duchovny went, I'm not going to be a TV guy anymore. I'm going to be.
Here it comes.
Evolution.
Yeah.
Anybody remember this movie?
Yeah, I do.
I saw it in a theater.
Yeah. I've seen it. I don't remember anything about it, but.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, probably.
It's not very good.
Came and it went.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very hyped, and then it just.
Has there ever been a case of where the TV actor who was really popular announced he didn't want to do TV anymore? He was too good for it. Then he goes to movies, and then he actually succeeded.
It's always a surprise, isn't it? It's never, you know, Bruce Willis didn't. Well, maybe he did. Bruce Willis, I called him. Bruce Willis. I'm going to go with it. I don't care.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis didn't make a big hubbub about, you know, going into movies when he did Die Hard, did he?
Yeah, that was a surprise hit.
In fact, everybody was like, why is he doing that? They were
hiding him in the ads. They didn't want to make the emphasis it was a Bruce Willis movie. And then he came off so well after the first week or two, word of mouth was so good, and he got praise for his performance. Then they started putting him in the ads. Like they were, you know, they redid the TV ads very quickly. They maybe emphasized, the stereo soundtrack and the, you know, the widescreen spectacle and everything.
Maybe the secret sauce is for guys like that transitioning over to movies to just keep their mouth shut.
Yeah, keep quiet.
Yeah, and also it would help if they were in a good movie. You know?
Yeah, that helps too.
Duchovny made a big thing about it, and then he kept coming back to X-Files and then leaving, and it was really weird.
Yeah, he was. Wasn't he kind of in and out? He's in and out on the Robert Patrick season.
He is.
Evolution was 2000, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think it was.
It's got Sean William Scott, and that's when he was in everything.
I remember on the commercials, they made a huge deal about it being from the creators of Ghostbusters. They were trying to make it a Ghostbusters hit.
Had to plug that nostalgia because they didn't have much else to sell it on. You know, nobody thinks funny when they think David Duchovny.
No.
He's too dry and too kind of drab in his screen presence to be like funny.
He also tries to be sexy.
Right.
I guess it works.
If you want to see some nightmare fuel, go look up David LaChapelle's photo shoot for X-Files. If you're familiar with David LaChapelle, you already can probably imagine what this is like. But go look up David LaChapelle X-Files promo shoot. It's terrifying. And it's
I'm putting it in my search engine right now. So look at it after the show. Or maybe during a dry spot on our show.
The last thing I want to point out, not a movie, it's a video game, but it's Cursed Castilla for the Switch. And the reason I bring it up is that it's a game that it's a side scroller game that kind of feels like Ghosts and Goblins. But I was looking at making of stuff and they were talking a lot about El Cid with Charlton Heston being a big inspiration. And I thought that was super cool.
That sounds fun.
And yeah, I was playing this today and it's a lot of fun. If you like stuff like Ghosts and Goblins, it's like that. It's not quite as crazy hard, but it's got a lot of Spanish imagery and medieval Spanish imagery. It's very cool. And like Charlton Heston was featured heavily in the booklet that went with it. So I thought that was cool. Anyway.
Oh my God, I'm looking at these LaChapelle photos. What the hell did you just tell me to look?
Oh man, we should, let's see here.
Holy hell.
LaChapelle X-Files.
I mean, I've always seen the one with Anderson and the Creature from the Black Lagoon that's been reprinted a lot, but.
Oh man. You know. Oh yeah, that one's actually pretty cool.
That's a good one. The others, however.
The others are all terrible.
I don't know what the hell I'm looking at. Jesus. They like all these articles that it links to are like, it's going viral again. <It's> just, we have to be reminded it's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something else. There's like David Duchovny, like in, you know, S&M gear. And
yeah, he's like in leather pants and, you know, his shirt's open. He's jumping like Tom Cruise.
He's got all of
always his... did on Vanity Fair covers.
I'll sure. take your word for it.
Yeah. Don't look it up.
I would share my screen, but I'm not going to.
Yeah, don't.
I think I'll spare issues. You all. You can all. Yeah. I'm not going to inflict that. You all can look it up on your own. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's the Yuletide season. You don't think of Christmas without thinking of Duccio Tessari's Pistol for Ringo.
Yes.
Starring Giuliano Gemma, right, guys?
That's never. Correct. Never does a Christmas go by.
No.
You two are being facetious, but I'm not. You two are being facetious, but I certainly am not. I haven't seen this in a long time.
It's been a few years for me. I think I watched it when the Arrow Blu-ray came out. And so with the movie we're doing is Pistol for Ringo, directed by Duccio Tessari, starring Giuliano Gemma from 1965. One thing I was struck by this movie is that it is not a typical spaghetti Western. Would you agree with that, Eric?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The let me take you through my reasons, okay? One, it's an early spaghetti Western that's not a Fistful of Dollars or Django ripoff. It has little bits of that plot. It actually, you know, we were talking about Die Hard. That's a later film that it reminds me more of. But you have Giuliano Gemma, who's a much more handsome figure. Like, the actors in this feel more like traditional Western actors. They're not like Charles Bronson or Clint Eastwood or Franco Nero or... Well, Franco's pretty handsome. But
they dirty him up.
Yeah, yeah.
They give him wrinkles and things.
Yeah, Tomas Milian. You know, he's a very handsome guy, and it takes place at Christmas. I think the only thing that was kind of typical was that it has an Ennio Morricone score. But what did you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, 1965 is a year before Django, and it's a year after Fistful of Dollars. It's the year for A Few Dollars More in Italy. 1965 is still too early, I feel, for there to be some sort of formula that people can latch onto. That said, at the very first shot of the movie, it's these two guys, awkwardly, it's not quite as grandiose as something like a Leone movie. It's just almost theatrical in the way it's presented. These two guys meet in the middle of the street, and they stare at each other pretty hard for about a few seconds, and you think, oh, we're going to see a traditional showdown. Nope, that it quickly they greet each other with Christmas greetings. So already you're told from the very beginning that this is going to be something a little bit different from what you've come to expect. Of course, again, I say that with there not really being a formula established as of yet. Yeah. None of that stuff would really kick in until 66, the next year, with Django itself being a dollars clone.
Well, and
but I see what you mean, actually. I didn't think of that. There is sort of Ringo does play both sides.
Yeah,
a little bit. Yeah,
he does. But you know what side he's on. I feel like Clint's character, he's out for himself. Mm-hmm. Whereas Ringo is more like a good guy. You know,
he's not completely virtuous. He does take the money at the end, his percentage. But ultimately, yes, you're right. You know, he's not going to let the hostages get killed, or at least as far as he's able to.
Because Clint's character is out for himself, period. You know, Ringo's character I did feel like he's going in there. He's going to save the day. Yeah, he's going to take his money. But, you know.
Right.
He feels more like a good guy.
Yeah. Clint also has his one moment where he helps Marisol and her son. That was clearly just thrown in there to not make the guy look like a complete son of a bitch.
Well, because when they played it on TV, they had Monty Hellman shoot that extra stuff, you know, to make Clint's character be on a, he's like a fed.
It's like Harry Dean Stanton wearing a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
Dressed up like Joe Blanco.
Yeah. I remember Monty going, yeah, Clint said he saw it on TV, and he was like, I don't remember shooting this stuff. And that made me feel really good. Yeah.
He's sanctioned by the government in that one, in that group. Yeah.
the fed with no name,
yeah,
which is funny because that's what they did to in Zatoichi Michio Jimbo. The twist is Mifune is not playing the original Yojimbo, he's playing a federal agent posing as that character.
I didn't capture that.
So it's like he's not playing the real Yojimbo,
he's not playing Sanjuro,
Yeah, he's not playing that character at all. He's actually playing a federal agent. It's revealed like in the third act or in the finale that he's actually a federal agent. Yeah. So it's maybe they saw that and said, hey, let's work this in.
Does Zatoichi say nice try, Fed, at any point?
I wish. That's what he should have done. It's like you work for the man in subtitles, you know.
But I think the sequel, The Return of Ringo, feels more like a traditional spaghetti western.
It's very serious. It's the Ulysses myth.
Yeah.
Pistol is a very, even though it's really violent, it's so cavalier about its violence. The Mexican bandits are lining up these people and shooting them. And
they just shoot one every now and then.
Yeah, every now and then. But the way that the killings go on, sometimes it becomes a little serious. Like the kid starts crying and Ringo consoles him with not the greatest advice ever. It's just like, hey, no use crying for the dead kid. It doesn't do any good.
Yes, screw this old man.
But other times it'll be like very flippant, like Fernando Sancho, the head bandit, would throw the gun and it would land on the floor and it would go off and shoot somebody in the back. It's almost like played for laughs, kind of. But yeah, Pistol for Ringo is very much a lighthearted movie. Return of Ringo is a moodier, atmospheric kind of tale.
Yeah, because I remember when I saw it, I was kind of taken aback because I remembered. Because Pistol for Ringo was so, you know, Ringo's kind of a more, you know, sort of devil may care attitude.
Yeah.
And then you get to Return of Ringo and you're going.
Yeah, it's the same thing with most Italian Italian Westerns that are part of a series. Sartana also, even though there's more of a thorough line through that, in one movie at the beginning, he's a apparition-esque. There's something preternatural about him. And then by the second movie, he's a little bit more flesh and blood. And by the end of the series, he's basically James Bond.
Yeah.
There's no consistency there. The same thing with the Sabata trilogy series. In the first film, it's heavily implied he fought for the North. By Return of Sabata, it's heavily implied he fought for the South. The only Italian Western trilogy or series that I can think of that is consistent is Colizzi's trilogy with Bud Spencer and Terrence Hill. God Forgives I Don't, Ace High, and Boot Hill. Hmm. The continuity there is pretty solid. In fact, the second movie takes off from the end of the first film. And the third one is a little bit years down the line. There's a mention of the events in the first film. So but everything else is very, they didn't seem to care.
What about the Dollars films?
That's another one you can say there's no real continuity. I mean, he makes out with, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars, which equate to almost $1 billion today. And he's still looking for money by the third one. He wouldn't have had a lifetime to spend all that money.
I felt like the third one was a prequel because
it is
the horse blanket.
That's the one where he makes out with $200,000.
Yeah.
And yet, the events of Fistful of Dollars take place in the 1870s. So it's Good, Bad, the Ugly is the Civil War. So the latest that could be a 65. So we're talking a little less than 10 years. And he spent all that money. Unlikely, but.
Maybe he has a gambling problem.
Yeah. A Pistol for Ringo, it's more overt that they don't care about continuity. It's not the same character. Again, look at the timeline. Return of Ringo, it's immediately after the Civil War. Pistol for Ringo, it's 1894. They actually say the date in the English dub. I caught that this time. I don't think I'd caught that before. And I also found out that the town is Quemado, Texas, which is a real place. That's in a bit of dialogue. But yeah, no, it's a totally different character. Totally, it's just a spiritual sequel more than anything else.
Yeah. I don't think of the character in both movies as being the same person.
Not at all.
Yeah, it can't be.
There's technically a third film, at least to my thinking. The character is not named Ringo. What was that?
X.
There's a movie called Long Days of Vengeance, which is the same producer as these two Ringo films. In fact, that producer it's unsung. I mean, every Western that guy made is pretty much an outright classic. He did not make a bad Western. He made these two films. He made Long Days of Vengeance, which is almost a companion piece of these two films. You have some of the same cast, Nieves Navarro or Susan Scott, her pseudonym. She's in there. She's a femme fatale in Long Days of Vengeance. Gemma plays a similar character that he does in Return of Ringo, only the adaptation this time, I think, is a Count of Monte Cristo. It's very similar to Odessa in some ways. And then his fourth and perhaps his final, I could be wrong about that. Somebody check up on that. His fourth is really, really good. His fourth Western, it doesn't have Gemma in it, but it's The Relentless Four. Oh, no, excuse me. That's a different film with Adam West. The Ruthless Four. Watch
with Leonard Mann and Woody Strode, right?
No. What are you thinking of? No. Did Leonard Mann do a Woody Strode movie?
No. Okay, it's Woody Strode and who? It's not Ed Kooky Burns.
No, because what you're thinking of is The Unholy Four. The Leonard Mann movie. Oh, very good, John. I forgot. Okay. Yeah, Unholy Four has Leonard Mann and Woody Strode. Ed's not in there. Ed Kooky Burns, no, not that one. No, The Ruthless Four is Klaus Kinski. I want to say Glenn Ford, George Hilton, and... it's not Ricardo Montalban, but what's the other kind of Mexican actor who's handsome and made his move to the Americas and became something of a star?
Gilbert Roland,
thank you.
Okay.
It's those four. I can't recommend The Ruthless Four enough.
Glenn Ford did a spaghetti western?
He did. He did The Ruthless Four.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. Okay, I haven't seen it.
You know what? I'm sorry. His co-star from 310 to Yuma, Van Heflin.
I'm not seeing Glenn Ford here. I see.
Yeah, it's Van Heflin. It's Van Heflin. Sorry.
It's got Joe D'Amato in it.
It does. That's a really good movie. Ruthless Four is very, very good. I would say that's, if I had to make a list of these things, I would definitely be somewhere in the top 20. Anyways, Eric Hawley, we talked too much about this producer, but he's made four standout films in that genre, and nothing else other than that in that genre. He went on, he was married to Nieves Navarro, Susan Scott. He went on to make some pretty standout giallos too. Death Walked at Midnight, Death Walked in High Heels.
Yeah, I've got the Arrow set of those.
All starring his wife.
It's kind of like Charles Bronson. Hey, Jill hey. Ireland, she's going to be in this movie, right?
You gotta cast Jill, or I don't work with you again, Walter.
They had no chance. They had no choice.
Didn't we do the Tessari Gemma 80s film, Tex?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, that's right. This is your second Dusha Tessari movie, I guess?
Yeah, because we did Tex on the show, and that movie sucks.
This is the better movie. Yeah.
Tessari had fallen by then.
And it was made in the 80s, so... after the spaghetti western cycle had passed, and it felt more like an Indiana Jones.
Yeah, it was based on apparently legendary comic book series in Italy, but yeah. You said they were still publishing that when you were in Rome.
I saw those things everywhere, man, in Naples and Rome. I saw Tex comics
everywhere. I should have bought a few, because they're a bitch to import. Absolutely terribly expensive to import.
Yeah, they were just in Italian, but I've actually seen there's a record store here in Dallas, and I saw they have like a foreign comic section. They have a ton of Tex comics in Italian.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I saw, I almost bought them, but then I saw they were in Italian and I was like, do I really need to buy this?
You know? Yeah, I'll just dub them when I read them, you know, just put mm-hmm. it in my own dialogue.
Now's it, if you want to go to Italy, John, now's the time. Apparently it's dirt cheap.
Oh really?
That's what I hear.
That's right, because the virus hit big in Italy first.
Yeah.
That was the country, so it's probably hurt their travel. So I have to think about that.
Hey, it's great. You know, I went a few years ago and it's magical.
You want to talk about the diehard similarities?
Yeah,
well, you can do that while I go charge this computer.
You
go for it.
First off, it takes place at Christmas. Highly unusual for a spaghetti Western to take place at Christmas. And there's lots of Christmas trees. Yep. There's lots
the
of
the only one.
It's the only one, Eric?
There's a movie called Christmas Kid that takes place at the beginning. That Christmas is at the beginning of the film, but the rest of the movie is not. So I believe, to my knowledge, this is the only one.
Well, it's not just a line at the beginning of the film. You see a lot of Christmas trees. There's a Christmas feast.
Yeah.
During the hostage situation.
It gets mentioned throughout the film.
Yeah.
They remind the viewer that it's Christmas, like frequently.
And they're like, oh, what a way to spend Christmas.
Here. Yeah. It does not let you forget.
Yes.
But the plot has, so Ringo is this guy who is thrown in a jail for self-defense, and they're like, you know, we're gonna find you innocent, but these guys try to take him out at the beginning, and these banditos rob a bank and in the town, and they're trying to escape south across the Rio Grande into Mexico, and they end up taking over this ranch to kind of, because they can't escape, so they take over this ranch as like a self-defense thing. They want to get protection to get past the Rio Grande down to Mexico, and the sheriff decides to send in Ringo. They find him not guilty on self-defense, but they decide to send him in to pretend to be a bandit on the run, to go in with these bank robbers to try to save the day. And so that's the plot, basically. Did I miss anything, Eric?
That's about right.
Yeah.
Plots are not important here.
No. Spaghetti Westerns, it's like, we're just kind of along for the ride.
Hunter, they were grittier. Hollywood was just all pink shirts.
Yeah, it was all like white hats and black hats, right?
Yeah. White hats and black hats. It's unrealistic.
John and I were talking about it the other day, that there needs to be, once the boomers die off, there needs to be a lot of rectifying of cinema history concerning Westerns, usually.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing about spaghetti Westerns, is people mistake stuff being dirty and people being ugly for realism. And like, I think Joe Carducci really sort of had a good take in the Stone Mail, where he said it was like the Circus Maximus. He's like,
And he's the only boomer. He's the only boomer that realizes that.
No, yeah, exactly. He was talking about how, they had all these ideas for Fistful of Dollars that Clint Eastwood was kind of like, Americans aren't going to like that. Like, sort of the kind of stuff that Robert Rodriguez would jump on later with, like, rocket launcher, guitar cases and stuff like that. Spaghetti Westerns, Italians love comic books. They feel like comic book Westerns. They feel like very stylized, very, I don't think they feel realistic. And especially when, I'm watching a movie like A Time to Live, A Time to Die, and the Confederate fort is a castle.
Well, in this film,
which is a fun movie. I like that movie. But
yeah, the hostage situation in this, I remember Bill Connolly had written something in Spaghetti Cinema where he had noticed that they often depict things like hostage situations that, as far as he knew at the time, and he wrote this in the 80s, that never happened in the Old West, but they did happen in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
where you have these type of incidents where, you know, troops might siege, you know, lay siege on a town and, I don't know, holding people hostage, but captive or whatever. And maybe that was based on the experiences of, because a lot of these Italian filmmakers had been in World War II, and maybe they experienced some of that. And so that's where you get these crazy scenarios, as in basically the war influenced their Westerns more than any actual Western history.
Well, and that would make sense because, you know, Giulio Questi, who did Django Kill, which is a movie that we, early on, I think one of Eric's first shows with us.
I think it was my first. Yeah, we
did Django Kill, and that was a movie I remember thinking was awesome. And then we did a show, and I was like, wait, this kind of sucks.
Yeah, I think I opened by saying that I don't like this movie.
Yeah, I know. Because I was going, oh, yeah, we're going to do Django Kill. This is a good spaghetti Western. Yeah, because you knew Tomas is in it. And, you know, and I remember when I saw it when I was much younger, thinking, you know, wow, this is kind of a surreal, weird movie.
It's so metal. That's what you were doing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're like ripping the gold bullets out.
You're wearing like your Iron Maiden t-shirt.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, and you had like your long hair and poking exactly. through it. You know, you had your bong or whatever. It was like this. It's like metal Western ever. I heard that if you listen to the first episode of the Midnight Movie Cowboys, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Right.
I was on the show.
This was Schlubby Metalhead Hunter.
This is when you and Stu had like long shoulder length hair. You're like, oh, dude.
I don't know if my hair was ever shoulder length.
It was like Wade's World. And you're like,
you guys my hair was about. Like a helmet. It would go up this way.
Yeah, mine never grew long. It just kind of grew back, like mine, thick.
I could never do like Dave Mustaine hair. Like,
yeah, I can't do it either.
I can't do it. With Django Kill, I just remember going, this movie's not that good, but Giulio Questi was in World War II. You know, he was one of these partisans who fought in the hills. And when you look at that movie as kind of a, you know, fascists versus anti-fascists movie, it makes sense in that lens. Because there's these like black shirt dudes and they're all gay. They're all basically Nazis. You
know, like, personally, I liked it when Thomas Milian punched out Goldilocks. I think that was the best part of the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Couldn't forget that scene.
But none of that applies to something like A Pistol for Ringo, which is all, as you said earlier, it's very clean cut. Everything's clean cut.
Yeah, like Ringo asked for milk.
Yeah, he doesn't
like,
drink.
Destry Rides Again, like Jimmy Stewart. Destry
he
Rides
doesn't
Again.
Drink, but he smokes. He has a cigar at one point.
Right. He does smoke. He does smoke the cigar. No, that was seen as a bad thing back then. They loved smoking. Doctors recommended it.
He's a very wholesome figure for a spaghetti Western lead. You know, they all smoke. They all drink. They're all like, kind of look like Clint. You know, they.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he looks like, you know, very fresh faced.
Well, he's introduced as playing hopscotch.
Yeah, he's playing hopscotch with kids.
But no, you're right. You're right. You know, Italian Westerns, there's this idea that they're all gritty and they're all like Clint and the moral ambiguity, which honestly, I mean, like, look at something like The Naked Spur. Like, you can't get much more ambiguous as to the motives of the lead, Jimmy Stewart, and that was like an abundance of 50s Westerns were like that.
Yeah.
So
The Searchers
is another one. And so it's just like this rewriting of history. All this stuff needs to go once the proprietors of that rewritten history go away, because otherwise they're always going to be there and say, oh, you're wrong. And I don't want to call anybody out, but you had a thread about a week ago. I didn't jump in because I was just like, why am I even going to bother? Where somebody was claiming that, all those 50s Westerns, all of them are all bloodless and the rear projection in the background and all this stuff. And I'm like, honestly, if you were to accumulate all of the squibs, because they did start using squibs as early as the 50s, we're not talking Peckinpah levels, but
no.
If you were to accumulate all those Westerns from that decade, they would probably surpass the amount of times you'd see squibs in all 15 years of the cycle of the spaghetti Western.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at American Westerns, I think they're much more morally complex than the Italian.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Italian Westerns are comic books. They are. They really are.
Yeah. They're comic books with, you know, they're like Todd McFarlane comics with Spawn, you know, or something, where it's like, ooh, he's dark, you know. Yeah. Whereas, like, I think directors like John Ford and Anthony Mann were actually grappling with very morally complex subjects, you know, that they were dealing with. Yeah, you know, you have your American Westerns, you got your singing cowboys and stuff, but that's wholesome stuff, you know, sure. That has its place. But
even some of those B Westerns got pretty nasty.
Yeah, you know.
Do you remember Massacre Time, the opening of Massacre Time with the guy getting ripped up by dogs?
Yeah. Which I just got on Blu-ray. I need to watch.
I gotta get that box set. Actually.
Yeah, I got that.
That's a good box set. Yeah. The only loser of that box set is Pecos. I don't know why people like that movie.
I haven't watched my Blu-ray set from the late Lamented the Wild East productions.
Oh yeah.
That's both Pecos movies.
I have those two. There is a B Western with Roy Rogers where he plays himself called Eyes of Texas. And it's about this unscrupulous bitch who murders people. I forget what the scheme is. It has something to do with an orphanage. So it's like a Three Stooges movie or something. And she murders people with her Dobermans. Yeah, it's worth
like
watching.
Hannibal, it's like Hannibal with like,
it's like Hannibal, but with Roy Rogers and Trigger. Yeah, I'm sure, you know what, we'll get into it a little bit, because I think where most of the, you hear about what spaghetti Westerns were influenced by, whether it was the World War II remembrances or what have you, but honestly, I think a lot of it comes with wacky stuff, anyway, the wacky stuff. A lot of it comes from American B Westerns. They must have played a lot in Italy. There is another Christmas Western called Trail of Robin Hood with Roy Rogers. And it's almost like an Expendables movie, because at the end of it, he gets help from Alan Rocky Lane and Tom Tyler and all of these icons of the B Western from a decade prior. And they all fight the bad guy, which are, I think they're stealing Christmas trees from a Christmas tree lot or something like that. I don't quite remember. But there is a scene where all of them get together and they interrogate this bad guy as to where the other bad guys are. The way they do it is they put them underneath a general store signpost, which for some reason has spikes around it. I don't know. And the sign is held up by ropes. And so each one of the guys, like Tom Tyler, takes a knife out and, you know, cuts the one of the ropes. And so it goes lower and gets closer to the guy. Meanwhile, there's nothing really bounding this guy to the floor or anything like that. He could just leave, but for whatever reason, he's just there. This is all stuff that you see in Italian Westerns all the time. If you dig deeper than Leone, you're going to see some goofy torture stuff. You're going to see some goofy interrogation scenes. You're going to see weird stuff all the time. And I mean, that's not the only example I can give, but like I've seen a lot of, I've been getting into B Westerns lately from the 50s and 40s and 30s, and they're filled or replete with stuff like this. And I have a feeling that the Italian filmmakers had seen those films, because every time I see one, I'm like, oh, that's like the scene, the gladiatorial arena in Hate Thy Neighbor with George Eastman. And this is this over here. I just keep seeing weird stuff like that. And it's all seems to stem back a mere decade to Roy Rogers movies or maybe some Gene Autry stuff. It's very strange to think
the Durango
where it came
kid
from.
Or something. Yeah.
The Durango Kid. It's strange to think that's where it came from, considering that those movies are considered by a certain age demographic, but to be kiddie nonsense. And it is kiddie nonsense, but that's where these supposed, you know, grittier minded filmmakers are taking their inspiration from, at least to my mind.
Yeah.
From what I'm seeing.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like when people go, I remember when I was in high school, it was like anime is for adults because they say fuck. You know, or
I remember
there's blood and guts, or there's sex, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like, okay, but is it really?
Yeah, I'm not saying all, you know, there's attempts at realism and trying to be a little bit more adult, but I would say I'd venture 85% of the Italian Western output is basically kids playing cowboys and Indians.
Yeah. Really is.
Inspired by Donald Duck comics. Donald Duck and Out West.
Very much inspired by comic books, very much inspired by kiddie Westerns from the 50s in America. It really is. And all that is going to have to come out at some point once the gatekeepers are gone.
And right. Like, you know, so much of Westerns is just like, it's like you open Phil Collins's book on the Alamo and it's got a picture of him dressed up like Fess Parker. When he's a little kid, you know, I mean, so much of Westerns is just, it's just our little kid fantasies, you know, it's just how pretentious do we want to be about them really?
You right.
Know? You know, we just want to kind of pretend, like with anime, it's like our cartoons. No, these are serious cartoons.
These are graphic novels, I'll have you know.
Yes. This is
Batman
this...
says shit. It's a graphic novel. It's a Batman comic for adults.
Yes. Frank Miller Batman swears.
Yeah, it should be a comic book for nobody because it's not a comic for kids, clearly, but adults shouldn't be reading any of that garbage either.
No, they shouldn't.
They are.
Right. It's the stuff that it's like, you know, you had your friend whose mom John, you won't understand this, but you will, but you know, it's like you'd have your friend who would buy Spawn comics, whose mom would buy him Spawn comics, and you'd go like, oh yeah, hell yeah, we're gonna read some Spawn comics.
Yeah. Because
you have to be 18 to buy those, you know.
Yeah. Now comic books are for kids, and if you're an adult reading comic books, I mean, that's something fine, great. But at the same time, acknowledge that this is for, if you're past a certain age, this is for shut-ins. But shut-in culture has become mainstream culture. Look at it. Exhibit A. Exhibit A.
Right within reaching distance. Skaranko's shield, baby.
No, yeah. I mean, I got stuff too. I already mentioned that I had that Dick Tracy, you know, comic strip book.
I got Terry and the Pirates, which actually was read by adults in the newspapers back in the 40s. Yeah. So
was Dick Tracy, for that matter.
Yeah, Dick Tracy, the Phantom, all that stuff was.
I was reading the
grown ups too.
I was reading the new Dick Tracy comics, and you know, they have their little Crime Stopper tips.
And oh, yeah. Like, they still run that?
Yeah.
Remember when we did the show, we saw like that week's strip?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Where he was like a Phantom of the Opera type villain or something.
Yeah, he
was like Lon Chaney. But like they have their Crime Stopper tips. And the one I saw was, don't post your vaccination card on social media, because people can steal your identity, moron.
Oh, man.
And it had like somebody with a mask on going,
it's official, that comic
is my vaccine card, look, I'm back.
It's official, that comic has run too long. No more.
Like Crime Stoppers, yeah, don't do that because people could steal your stuff.
You know. Oh god, I don't know, the Dick Tracy character would not be down with running the country like 1930s Germany.
No, as Dick said on that TCM special, you know, Warren Beatty, too much of a liberal.
Yeah, the Warren Beatty self-loathing coming right through that whole segment.
Yeah, you know, Warren Beatty, he made that movie Reds. No good. No good.
Same guy.
Warren Beatty was a good guy. He would have stood up and clapped when Elliot,
you know what? Dude, got the honorary
Oscar. He did.
Honestly, Warren Beatty was that was actually quite something for him to say that, because you'll notice actors today, like who's the guy who plays the libertarian, the Ron Swanson character on Parks and Rec?
Nick Offerman.
Like, I remember he was on Twitter going, Ron Swanson would never back this sort of thing. He'd totally vote for Biden and all this shit. It's like, you know, give Warren Beatty credit. He separates the actor from the character, you know, that he's playing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah. Okay, Nick, so you're saying that Ron Swanson is really you. And it's, you know, and he really is, just pretends to be this libertarian that hates the government. Yeah.
He's like Jeffrey Tucker or something.
Yeah. Jerking off on a Zoom, though.
No, that's Jeffrey Toobin.
Oh, I get them all confused.
No, Jeffrey Tucker's like the bow tie libertarian, you know.
I don't even think I've seen Jeffrey Tucker on anything.
McDonald's is the greatest expression of capitalism.
Oh, that crap. Well, the guy that's Reason Magazine does it too.
Yeah.
Nick, whatever his name.
Reason Magazine is like that type of libertarianism.
It's a cesspool. I'm embarrassed I used to subscribe.
It's not Dave Smith or Michael Malice.
No, not at all. It's a lot of, legalized pedophilia or whatever.
Yeah. Like, dude, weed bro, you know.
Oh, wow. Two of my cats are making cameos.
I was going to say, John, what is this? What's going on?
You know? The cat that was on earlier, if eagle-eyed viewers will notice, has one eye. He has only one eye.
Really? They call is it a she? So can
I was going to call him Christina Lindbergh if it was a female, but he was a boy cat, so we came up with the name Quasi, sort of a riff on Quasimodo, and he resembled a character on that Octonauts cartoon my kid watched.
Should have still called her Christina Lindbergh.
Chris Lindbergh.
Chris Lindbergh.
I almost called him Nick Furry.
Nick Furry.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, the Facebook friend actually recommended, Jim Jemitis actually recommended that for his name. But this is Fez. He's the tailless. I got a cat with no tail, a cat with three legs. This is the cat with no tail. He's a Manx. And then I got a cat with one eye who made an appearance earlier.
What do you guys think of the casting in Pistol for Ringo?
I like the
cast.
I like Giuliano Gemma quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of like making him typical spaghetti Western guy, the arrow release makes him look like Clint in Unforgiven on the cover.
It looks like AIDS Ringo. It looks terrible. He looks like he's super thin and old, and he doesn't look like any of that in either incarnation of Ringo's.
Very weird cover art.
Thinking about that cover art today, and I was just like, they just give this to somebody who heard the term. It's like the most cliche of Western imagery. If there's a cow skull, I believe, or a bull skull or something. That's imagery. It's not in the films, either film. I was just like, hey, they hired him, whoever it was, and could you make this cover? And like, oh, it's a Western. Okay. Spit it out and it looked terrible. I didn't like it.
But you got George Martin as Sheriff Ben.
George Martin, a Spanish actor. He died about a month ago.
Really?
Yes, he did. He died. I met him once in his Miami high-rise apartment. He owned so much real estate in South Florida. He was a billionaire, if not close to it.
Oh my gosh.
And he was known as the Baron of Biscayne.
No kidding.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, when I met him, he was dating somebody who was like 70 years his junior.
What a king.
And eventually married her, as I found out this last month. I'm like, I wonder if he ever, and he did. She was the widow. So she made out like a bandit.
Well, that guy, you know, here, king, you dropped this king emoji. King emoji.
Out of all the Italian Western actors that I've met and some befriended, he's probably been the most successful because he knew what to do with his money.
And you also and, got Fernando Sancho as the villain.
I've seen him in a ton of stuff.
Yeah, he was in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, he is the ultimate fat guy Mexican in these movies. A lot of people think Mario Braga in those Leone movies. No, it's all about Fernando Sancho.
He's in so many. You scroll through it. There is so many. If you've watched any spaghetti Westerns, he's in a lot of them.
Yeah, at least 25 where he plays the same character he plays here. And occasionally he would play a gringo, not often.
Did he play the gringo and get the gringo with Mel Gibson?
Should have.
Well, he's not even in that because he's been dead for forever.
He's been dead since 1990.
Yeah. So yeah,
very long filmography he's got.
Yeah. I remember I was stunned. Aldo Sombrell showed up in Operation Condor, the Jackie Chan movie, as a Nazi.
Aldo Sombrell. Too kind of swarthy for a Nazi, but okay.
I know, but he's playing a Nazi in a Jackie Chan movie.
That's really strange. I'm of the opinion that, and I actually want to tell a story about George Martin, not one that I witnessed myself, but it was in the Miami Herald, but we'll get to it in a second. It's very funny. But I'm of the impression that A Pistol for Ringo and also Return of Ringo, because it's the same crew and cast in different roles, they are probably the most well-casted of any of these Italian movies I've seen. I think everybody plays their part. I mean, Fernando Sancho's a really good, Gemma's really good. Nieves Navarro, aka Susan Scott, she's great as the femme fatale.
Yep.
There's not a weak link in this cast.
There's really not. Everybody, you know, a lot of spaghetti westerns kind of meander, or they sort of they can feel kind of baggy. This one is one of the tighter ones, I think. You know, even though it's almost 2 hours, it really feels a little more like you're getting a really straight thriller with not a lot of filler, I guess.
It's longer than I remember. I was a little worried coming back to this. I hadn't seen this in probably over 10 years. And I remember I watched this a ton of times during the mid-aughts and the remainder of that decade. And it was one of my favorite thing. It was one of my favorite movies in terms of that genre. And I was a little worried coming back to it because I've come back to a lot of these lately and I'm like, God, this doesn't work anymore. And while it doesn't hit the heights that it used to for me, it's still solid. And I've always had a few problems with it, really. It's back then, I'm trying to go back to somebody who doesn't exist anymore, you know, 2005 Eric. But his thinking was it was pretty much perfect, except for one little thing, which was George Martin, the sheriff, the clean-cut sheriff, is in love, and she's in love in turn. They're going to get married with the leading lady. But when Ringo shows up on the scene and the leading lady and him are stuck together in this situation, there's a romance that's sort of building. And you'd think like, oh, okay, it's going to be an interesting little drama between, you know, versus clean-cut sheriff and Ringo's bad boy image. It comes to nothing. Mm-hmm. Comes to absolutely nothing. Even though they build up on it. That was always an issue with me. I expected it this time, obviously, so it was less of an issue. My issue mostly was it was a lot longer than I remember.
Yeah, it's longer than I remember, too. I remember looking at the runtime and going, oh, Return of Ringo is shorter?
Yeah. Yeah, that's not how I remember it.
Me either.
Yeah, and Return of Ringo, I was of the impression that Pistol was better just because it was much more fun, and it is still. That it's much more fun. I think Return of Ringo has usurped its place for me. I saw it back to back with Pistol just for the hell of it. Return of Ringo was not one that I visited too often. I'm like, you know what? Return of Ringo is actually a better movie.
I need to revisit Return of Ringo because when I watched it, the one time I've watched it, I was expecting it to feel more like this movie. And it's totally different, and I need to watch it again without that baggage because I was wanting Pistol for Ringo too, and I didn't get that, and
it's a slow burn movie.
Yeah, it is. And I remember sitting there watching it going, I'm kind of bored, you know, what's going on? What?
Yeah. Don't go into it. Go into it with the mindset that it's a totally different thing and just let it. I honestly think it's better.
Now that I have that, I need to go watch it again because it's not a sequel to this film. It's just the same director and actor.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. It's not Die Hard 2.
It's more of an opera. It's like a Italian opera without the music.
With the Odyssey plot.
Yeah. It's totally it's totally it's an opera essentially.
It's like with all these Italian films where they use the name of the character to sell it, you know.
Yeah, that was all point, because I think Miss Faringo was very successful.
Like Adios Sabata, not a Sabata movie.
Right.
No.
Return of Ringo has some great, great scenes in it, mostly to do with the music, because the music, unlike a lot of these things, the music actually is in sync with the action that's going on.
It is.
A lot of scenes.
Yeah.
And, you know, you listen to these Italian tracks on CDs or, dare I say, Quentin Tarantino movies or something, and you're listening to them like, oh, man, this sounds great. And then you go back and you watch the movie, it was originally scored for, and it's just like, this doesn't fit well. And there's a piece of music in A Pistol for Ringo where that's very apparent, when they're gathering up all of the hostages on a wagon when they're going to do the switch at the end. There's a piece of music, beautiful piece of music by Morricone called The Slaughter. It doesn't go with the film at all. It's just like slapped on there lazily. But Return of Ringo, definitely. The music coincides with the action on screen. And I'm going to give a positive to Quentin, actually, because I think he uses the Morricone music from The Mercenary in Kill Bill Volume 2, where she's punching herself out of the grave. I think that music works better there than it does in the arena showdown between Franco Nero is the referee in that, basically. He doesn't participate, but you know what I'm talking about. Jack Palance and Tony Musante.
Camelot.
No, but the music in that, Le Arena, however you pronounce it, works better, unfortunately, in Volume 2 than it does in its proper movie, I think.
Not surprising.
But yeah, I would recommend watching Return of Ringo with some fresh eyes.
Yeah, I'm gonna do that because the first time I watched it, I was wanting what this movie was.
Of course, yeah.
That's not what I got.
Yeah, that was my issue 15 years ago too.
Yep,
with it. Yeah.
Well, I first saw them 30 something years ago, and I rented Return of Ringo first, and really liked it. And in fact, made a copy of it and revisited the film a few times. Pistol for Ringo, I rented once, and because I'd seen Return of Ringo first, I was completely thrown off by the kind of, you know, hey, it's a Western type of attitude. It was because it was such a different film. And
hey, Merry Christmas!
Yeah, it's better in principle, but and I remembered all that stuff, and plus it didn't translate as well with the pan and scan. Like, this is the first time watching it 30 years later, seeing it in widescreen, because I'd only seen like a pan and scan version first. And, it was interesting. But yeah, it's two completely different films. And this one plays a lot better in widescreen than it did on that painful pan and scan that I rented oh so many years ago.
I can't imagine.
Oh, yeah. Believe me, when I look at this stuff now, I'm like, how did I ever sit through a pan and scan? And sometimes I'll try to watch a pan and scan if something's on Tubi, like an old kung fu flick. I'll cut it off after 10 minutes. I can't do it. It's like, you know, we just put up with it because that's the best we could do back then. But now it's unacceptable. Your eyes can't adjust to it.
One of my favorites is Brits talk about watching Deep Red, and they talk about the talking statue, because there's this scene where Dario Nicolodi and the lead actor in Deep Red, whose name escapes me, they're talking to each other. One of them's over here, one of them's over here, and there's a statue in the center, and the stand just has the statue.
I know it. Yeah, that's under the that's the American title, right? The murder, the axe murders,
the hatchet murders.
Yeah, that's when I was introduced to Deep Red. I had a DVD, but it was VHS transfer. It was pan and scan. And honestly, if they were to clean that up, I prefer that version of the movie to the Italian one, because the Italian one has like stupid comedy bits in it.
Yeah.
Deep Red is not a movie that's not an Argento film that I revere. I remember I'd seen some of his movies and I saw Deep Red, and I remember thinking, it's fine, but
for some, that's their favorite.
I might be one of those people. I might be one of those people. I don't know. Deep Red. The main problem with Deep Red is anytime, because it's basically what I call a gothic giallo, because there's like a spooky house that they go into and stuff, yeah. as opposed to a regular giallo, which is just basically a slasher.
Yeah.
Other ones in that kind of subgenre category would be Evelyn Came Out of the Grave or The Night That Evelyn Came. You know, there's a gothic aspect to it. There's a gothic castle. The Red Queen Kills Seven Times is another one. I think I would fit Deep Red in there. Because it's about clairvoyancy, and they go to this almost castle-like house.
That's something Argento loves. He loves psychics and stuff.
Right. And anytime anything spooky happens in the movie, anytime like I don't get scared by horror films anymore, unfortunately. But back when I watched it, I was just like, "Ooh, this is getting creepy." I'd watch it in my room at night. It's dark and stuff. Then this rockin' fucking soundtrack by Goblin kicks in, and it just dissipates all of the thrill that you have.
Yeah, I always loved watching like opera and then Motorhead kicks in.
Yeah.
Not scary anymore.
Well, but Creepers Phenomena. Has a like Iron Maiden and Saxon kicking in on the soundtrack or whatever the hell.
Yeah.
I think there's a Motorhead track on there.
That one had moments that scared me just because they were so unexpected, like the deformed kid who stabs people. I would just remember going, "Oh!"
A chimpanzee to the rescue with the razor blade.
Yeah, yeah. There were moments in that were just so surreal and weird, and I just remember going, "Oh!" But I don't know. There were some like Deep Red that didn't really. I kind of like it when Argento just gets really weird, like with Phenomena or with like Inferno, where I'm just like, I don't know what's gonna happen.
You have to be in the right mindset for Inferno.
First time I saw it, I was in the right mindset.
Yeah, perfect. I like Deep Red better than Tenebrae. I think Tenebrae is kind of, it's good, but...
I like it has John Saxon in it, and I just keep expecting Bruce Lee to come out and like punch the killer in the face.
Yeah, I like it because it has those crane shots set to like a disco beat.
Yeah, you know, his best, Argento's best giallo of the 80s and possibly his best movie is probably Creepers. It's Phenomena.
I was surprised how good it holds up. It really was.
It's really good. But you know who else is in Deep Red? Giuliano Gemma.
Really?
Yeah, he plays the inspector or the detective.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's in it's Tenebrae, isn't it?
Did I say, what did I say? Tenebrae?
Oh, you said Deep Red. It's
Tenebrae. I didn't mean Deep Red. I'm sorry. I meant Tenebrae. Yeah,
that's right. Because he's telling, what's his name? He's like, hey, don't tell me the ending. I don't want to be surprised by your look.
That's right. He is a fan of his. He quotes Arthur Conan Doyle, too.
Did you know Gemma was in a Woody Allen film?
What film?
To Rome with Love.
Really?
Oh, that's right. That was just before he died. I forgot all about that.
Oh, wow.
Now I got to see it.
I got to totally see it now.
Yeah. That's crazy. I wonder, Woody's such a cinephile, you'd think that he would know, right?
You'd think so. He might. You know, Woody's...
If it was Scorsese, there'd be no question.
But the thing about Woody is you think like, okay, he's Woody Allen. He's only watching the Fellini or something. But... Woody likes like Knicks games and beer.
Knicks games and
beer. You know, like Woody's a little more, I think he's a little more populist than he lets on. I'll bet he likes trashy.
He likes Knicks games. He likes beer. He likes babysitting your kids. You know, these are all things. These are all things that every red blooded American likes.
And doesn't like James Bond movies. I know that. But
he doesn't? Oh, it's too bad.
He doesn't.
I just don't like them. They're just so. I don't like tuxedos. You know.
I'm reading the oral history of James Bond that I think it's Mark Altman and Edward Gross put out. I checked it out from the library, and it's one of those 800 page books with all these different quotes that. Starts out Woody Allen going, I think I saw Dr. No, but and I did like it. And, I wouldn't sit through a James Bond movie except under duress or whatever.
I was in Casino Royale with Orson Welles and just.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to that part. Supposedly there's a big chapter on that. So that'll be something to look forward to.
Oh, man.
That's funny.
Where he's Jimmy Bond.
Yeah. That's a terrible movie. I know it has its weird fans, but it's an awful film. It's actually tough to sit through.
Yeah.
I'd rather watch Operation Kid Brother with Neil Connery.
That's not easy to sit through either.
Yeah, it's not, but it's better than that damn thing.
Great Morricone score.
Giuliano, you know, I need you. I want some of that boyish Ringo face.
He's probably sent over by the agency or something because he spoke English or something like that.
Probably, yeah.
I like what he knew who he was. I don't think he was a big fan of Tenebrae or something.
Oh, I love Tenebrae. I love the shots, the black glove killer ripping the page.
Unless he saw My Son the Barbarian. The peplum that everybody's under the impression it was given a comedy dub, which it was not, but the trailer made it look like it got a comedy dub because Mel Brooks did the trailer.
I know why Woody put him in the movie, because he was in The Leopard by Luchino Visconti.
He was in The Leopard, yeah. Terrence
Hill's in that. Yes, he is.
That's right. Yeah, Woody, I can't imagine after a certain point, probably like the mid-70s, that guy made, what, 2 films a year, or at least a film a year? He probably doesn't have time to watch movies.
I don't think he does.
Yeah, Woody was until recently, was very consistent. I've seen Gemma was in Ben-Hur as well.
Yeah, he is. He's, yeah, that's right. He started out as a circus act. He is an acrobat, and you can kind of tell in a fight scene here. Remember when he gets... He lands on his ass and then gets right back up.
Yeah.
Yeah. He always does the cool fights like that.
Yeah. I love that moment where you just back up. It was great.
Yeah. Everybody kind of had their gimmick. you have to mention Gemma was one of three of the most popular A-listers as far as genre filmmaking was concerned throughout the cycle, actually. The other two were, of course, Franco Nero and Tomas Milian. I'm talking about the Italians. I'm not talking about Clint Eastwood or Lee Van
Cleef. Sure.
Gemma was A-list and made a lot of great movies. And everybody had their own little gimmick, like Anthony Steffen, who's like kind of B-list. His gimmick seems to always be, there's always going to be a scene at least once where he's going to roll around on the ground and shoot people from there. Giuliano Gemma always showed off his acrobatic skill. Tomas was always going to be, you know, hidden behind makeup and wigs and things. Franco's gimmick was there was a machine gun, usually a machine gun, where he wipes out, even if it's for one scene, wipes out a bunch of people with a machine.
And he'll sleep with someone who's not Vanessa Redgrave.
Exactly. Well, that happens every day in real life. Not supposed to say that, Franco was so connected to the machine gun thing that in a movie that he stars with Zorba the Greek. What's his name? Very quick.
Zorba the Greek.
Anthony Quinn.
Anthony Quinn, thank you.
Yes.
He started with Anthony Quinn in a film called Deaf Smith and Johnny Ears, where Anthony Quinn plays a deaf federal agent. This is a Western, apparently based on an actual historical figure.
Well, Deaf Smith was one of the Texas revolutionaries. He was part of that, of Sam Houston's crew.
The movie has to do with Texas Revolution. Excuse me. In the 1830s. So that makes sense. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
we're talking about the same
person. Yeah, he was a scouter.
The movie takes place in the 1830s. It does deal with that historical figure. I'm sure it's widely phantasmical.
Yeah, Jeffrey Dean Morgan played him in Texas Rising.
So Deaf Smith hangs out with with this Spaniard played by Franco to excuse his accent. But anyways, at the end of the film, there's this big bloody battle in some fortress or something, and Franco gets atop of this Gatling gun and can't work it. He just can't get it to work. So they're playing with the idea that he doesn't know how to use the thing that he's most noted for. And then Anthony Quinn has to come in and show him how to use it. So that was 1918. That was 1970 something, 73, I want to say. So already, like, they were playing up to the audience, 8 years after Django? Like, oh, you think he's going to, you know, massacre a bunch of bad guys with this, not a machine gun, but a Gatling gun. Well, anyways, I'm losing you. So let's move on. Let's move on.
Well, I liked it in Camelot when we see Lancelot get on a machine gun.
That's what that movie needs. Enter the Ninja needed a scene of him.
Enter the Ninja needs a machine gun. Camelot needs a machine gun. Any Franco Nero movie that does not have a machine gun can greatly improve with a machine gun in it. This is a fact. This is a fact. Die Hard 2. Die Hard 2 has a few machine guns, but Franco doesn't man it. So
Franco could use a machine gun in Die Hard.
He could use one in the film.
In Django Unchained, he did not have a machine
gun. He needed a machine gun.
He needed to mow Jamie Foxx down.
Needed a machine gun. Letters to Juliet, he needed a machine gun.
That episode of Prime Suspect where he's sleeping with Helen.
Yes. The gay Kamikaze 75. What's that director called? Fassbender.
Fassbender, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Fassbender quarrel where Franco stars. He needed a machine gun. Mow down all of his sailor buddies.
There's that movie where he plays Saint Augustine. There's that
yes.
movie. Yes. Like he's standing there like he's old Saint Augustine or Augustine or however you want to say it, and the barbarians are coming in to destroy Hippo in Africa. He had a machine gun, he would have survived, you know.
And The Visitor, where he's playing Space Jesus,
he needed a machine gun.
Had an Uzi.
That's right, yes, yes.
Oh, he has an Uzi in that? I've never seen The Visitor.
That's what he needs.
Oh my God, that would blow my mind if Space
Jesus needed an Uzi. That's what he needed. So he's just talking to young people like hippies or whatever.
The Visitor is one of those movies that the Alamo Drafthouse like rediscovered and then they oversold it because it's just kind of a like a 70s possessed kid movie, but it just has some weird moments, and Alamo Drafthouse really focused on the weird moments. And then you watch it and you go, well, this is just like an Omen ripoff, you know?
Yeah, that's all. I remember when it was released in 79, it was just an Omen ripoff. That's how it was marketed. And,
I was going, Alamo made me feel like I was getting 2001, A Space Odyssey on a budget, you know, but no.
Yeah. Funny thing is like Neil Bortz has a cameo in it. And then he told me he was John Huston's stunt double in the film. And I mean, speaking of libertarians, there we go. We come back around to Neil Bortz.
Yes.
Anyway. Yeah, everybody's in that movie, including the black guy from The Farmer, Albert Popwell. Interviewed him recently. Yeah,
that's right.
It's Mike Malloy. Recently.
That's right. And we might have Gary Conway pretty soon. We may get him.
So, Eric, how often do we see Christmas in Westerns?
You know, not often, but it exists. I don't have a list that reaches over 10. Offhand, but there's certainly over 10 of those. Ones that we've probably all seen, Will Penny.
Mm. Yeah.
With Donald Pleasance.
With yes. Donald Pleasance. The Cowboy and the Indian with Gene Autry. Is not overtly Christmas, but the last 5 minutes makes up for that when he delivers a supply of Christmas gifts to an Indian reservation with his foreman dressed as Santa Claus and the kids all sing Silent Night. Obviously A Pistol for Ringo. There's quite a lot of films, actually. You know, nothing, it's not abundant, but it's there. I'm missing a lot in my brain right now. There's a TV movie called Christmas Mountain from 1980 with Slim Pickens. What else? You've seen a few, I'm sure.
Is it Three Godfathers Christmas?
Three Godfathers. Yeah. There's like five different versions of that. There's the 1916 Three Godfathers, then there's the 1919 version, which is called Marked Men, I think it's lost.
Yeah.
Then there's somewhere in the 30s, they made two of them, I believe. They made the Three Godfathers 37, and then they did something called Hell's Heroes, which is the same script. And then finally the John Wayne one, so that's six?
Yeah, there's a lot of versions of that movie.
That's a
Western nativity story.
Right. I mentioned earlier Trail of Robin Hood. It was one I can't recommend enough with Roy Rogers. Very, very fun movie. what else? It's just quite a few. Fort Defiance is one that I discovered like 5 years ago. It's with Ben Johnson, who doesn't get to play a lead all that much. No. I recommend Fort Defiance. It's on free for YouTube at the moment. In fact, I think films like Fort Defiance might have actually been a an influence on sorry, I'm looking at something outside the window. An influence on Italian Westerns. There's a cemetery scene, for those who've seen it, with wooden crosses. There's a cemetery scene in that it's straight out of an Italian Western. There's a showdown in it. I was surprised when I saw it. I believe this is early 50s, 51, something like that.
But Eric, how can that be? But because all those American Westerns were like singing cowboys and, you know, clean shirts.
Yeah, of course. All black hat, white hat. They're all racist towards the Indians.
They hate you. They're like pro-Indian genocide. It shocks me.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still waiting to watch a movie that's pro-Indian genocide.
Yeah, I haven't found it yet.
I know. I always hear that's all of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, still waiting to see that one.
And they wave the flag a lot too, Hunter. They wave like the
huge flag waving films, of course.
They're pro Confederate too. There are a lot of them pro Confederate.
They wave the.
They actually are.
That's actually not inaccurate.
That's the only thing that you've said that was not inaccurate. The Italians kept that tradition alive too. So many Confederates.
Yes, they did.
As heroes in films, except for Return of Ringo. He's the Union.
Right.
And Django as well is a Unionist. But yeah, no. A lot of the myths, like I said, a lot of the myths need to be debunked, especially for American Westerns. And I don't think any of the good work is going to get going until probably 20 years from now. If there's even, I mean, I guess we're all going to be alive in 20 years, hopefully. But, you know, there's... Once boomers leave, that's it. I mean, like a lot of stuff, all these comic book collections, all of these toy collections that all these people have that think it's going to be worth something someday, sell it now. Sell it right now. It's just going to be fucking worthless by 2040.
And also, but you know, a lot of these memes that come out of the boomer generation, they've bled down to Gen X.
Yes, it did. No, there's been no scholarship since the boomers that has changed any input into the Italian or American Western for that matter. Yeah.
When you see lists of great Westerns, you know, they include, you know, some of the Italian stuff, the revisionist stuff. You'll get like the Oxbow incident, you know, stuff that's kind of like Westerns for people who don't really like Westerns.
Westerns for liberals, you can just say it. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Westerns for people who don't like Westerns.
Lynching is wrong.
Liberal. Yeah, liberal in not the original definition of it, but yeah.
Yeah.
Right, the modern
definition. Lynching is wrong. Yeah, no shit. Thanks.
Lynching is wrong.
thank you for that. Thank you
Shouldn't
for that.
Be mean to the Indians.
No way, really? What a load of crap.
Very cruel to the Indians.
Yeah, no, just these kind of like message movie Westerns that are kind of like, okay, yeah, we know, okay.
You know, a lot of the Indians were villains movies, a lot of that stuff, if you actually watch the movies, which I know many of these people haven't, if you actually watch the movies, oftentimes there'll be a white guy that incites them into violence. There'll be an Indian agent, a corrupt one. Usually those guys were corrupt anyway. That seems to be the historical fact. Yeah. There'll be a merchant of something that will sell them fire water and get them in order to get them hyped up to do something. It's always a white guy behind all of it. So I don't know where all of this stuff comes from. About
it's because like Rock Hudson played an Indian or something.
Yeah. And there's so many, there's a ton. Yeah. Rock Hudson. Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, okay. I mean, the Rock Hudson is not, you know, the most positive portrayal of an Indian in Winchester 73. But like a Charlie Chan or something like that. Why are those films ostracized? Because a white guy played an Asian? Well, look deeper and see that the white guy is the smartest guy in the room. He's a positive figure.
Yeah.
I don't see the problem. I really don't. Even with something like Fu Manchu, which is a negative portrayal, obviously. Fu Manchu's a genius.
Yeah.
Well, you're watching Fu Manchu movies. That's one of those like things like Dr. Mabuse or Fantomas, where the villain is actually the person you're tuning in for.
He's the protagonist.
He's essentially the protagonist of the movie, but say he's treated as an antagonist, which he is. He's a protagonist, antagonist of the film. He's a genius. It is a positive portrayal in some form or fashion.
Well, the Charlie Chan movies have a criticism in the films, even in the 40s, where Sidney Toller is playing Charlie Chan, but of course, Key Luke and Phil Ahn are usually playing his kids. And they talk hip. They talk like 40s teenagers.
Right.
And his wife speaks completely normal English. And they'll have those scenes where they're all at the dinner table. He's got all his kids and his wife. They speak perfect, you know, California English. And Charlie's like, oh, you know, Sidney Toller's just, oh. It's almost like they're just pulling a gag on the viewer or whatever. Yeah. It's like, the Swede is playing a Chinese genius.
Yeah, we know it's ridiculous, but also there's a little bit of traditionalism in that and kind of conservatism where he wants his kids to not, you know, he wants his kids to sort of oversee the old traditions and things like that. But I lost my train of thought. Where were we? Key Luke. Key brought up Key Luke. There's an interview with Key Luke where somebody asked him, like, oh, you know, aren't you disgusted that, you know, this guy, this white man is playing? And it's like, and Key Luke was just like, well, who the hell else were you going to get? You know?
Yeah.
Like,
there were no middle-aged actors at the time who were Asian and spoke English. So it was a limited industry back then.
Movies back then were not marketed on the brand. I mean, some films were, but not many. It's not like today. They were marketed on who was playing Charlie Chan.
Right.
Yeah. I talk about that in my class about you know, how movie stars used to sell movies, and now it's brands that sell movies, and just how the way they market these things changes.
Yeah, and those Charlie Chan movies, by the way, very popular in China before the Communist Revolution there, the People's Revolution. Very, very popular films.
Speaking of racism, let's get back to Pistol for Ringo for 1 second, because I just remembered I have a George Martin story.
Okay.
So
produced the Beatles. Was that what you were going
to say? No, not that George Martin.
This is when George Martin's really racist, Hunter.
Jorge Martin, George Martin, his friends would call him Paco, which is funny because his name in Return of Ringo is actually Paco. Much like Fernando Sanchez's name in Pistol for Ringo is Sancho. I'm just going to call him Paco. So Paco, this is in the early 2000s. Where he had some dealings with Alex Rodriguez, who at the time was with the Marlins, I believe.
Right.
It's been a long time.
A-Rod.
A-Rod. And he had some dealings with A-Rod. And I don't know, everything went sour. George Martin showed up at his house, and because I guess A-Rod owed him a bunch of money. And you could look this up. It's on an article. And this is in the Miami Herald or something. And George Martin tells A-Rod, he gets pissed off. He's just like, you know what? Here, you know, back in Cuba, you're just some black guy who is good at baseball. And, you know, here you're a star. I don't buy it. Back home, you ain't nobody. You ain't shit. And then A-Rod picked up like a golf club or something and said, I'll show you. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Martin says, back in Cuba, you'd be some black guy who cuts cane. That's all you'd be. And A-Rod picks up a golf club and says, I'll show you a black man who can cut cane.
Oh, my God.
I was on the Miami Herald like back in 03 or something. Pretty funny.
Did you know that Martin was in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Jorge Martin, are you serious?
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, directed by
Duke. Oh, Kiss Kiss, Kiss Bang Bang by Duke Tessari. Okay, I thought you were talking about
the Shane Black movie.
Okay, that was your intent, of course. Yeah. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang with I've never seen, but I hear it's a good Bond parody.
Giuliano Gemma.
Yeah, which is also produced by Eric Coley. I don't think that guy did any wrong, really, in terms of what he chose. Yeah, Dusso Tussari is definitely a director of note. Honestly, even if he made just these two movies and ended up not doing anything else with the Westerns, or made bad Westerns, which he didn't. he would still be worthy of talking about. He's an interesting director, made a lot of good films, made a lot of interesting genre stuff.
Yeah, he did a lot of good. He did some good, like, Eurocrime stuff.
Yeah.
He did, I like his Zorro film with
Leon Delon. Yeah, it's good.
I liked, didn't he do some giallo films?
He did Bloodstained Butterfly, I believe.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah,
that's an interesting giallo film.
That's a good one, yeah.
Yeah.
Another Western of his I like is Franco Nero and Eli Wallach, and it has several titles, of course, like all these things. A Toast to Your Death, Amigo, or Turn the Other Cheek, or Don't Turn the Other Cheek.
Okay.
Long Live Your Death. Imagine Corbucci's Compañeros and turning the comedy up to 11, and that's what you have with Long Live Your Death. It's a very silly film, but also it also plays as an action film as well. Like, by the end of the movie, there's like 200 people that are dead.
And
it was originally a Corbucci movie, actually, but Franco Nero and him had a little tiff during Compañeros because Franco felt that Tomas was upstaging him, and Corbucci was allowing him to do it. And so they had an issue, and Corbucci was to make that kind of his third Zapata Western. It went to Tessari. And Corbucci was left to do another Zapata movie. What Am I Doing in the Middle of the Revolution? I'm sorry, Hunter, go ahead.
Didn't Tessari work on Fistful of Dollars?
Yeah, screenwriting. Script, right? Yeah, screenwriting credit. Yeah.
And a movie of his that I haven't seen but is in my to watch pile is The Cats. That's one that kind of has a good
rhythm. What's that one? I didn't hear you.
The Cats.
I don't know that one.
It's got Klaus Kinski, okay, and Rita Hayworth.
It's like a heist film.
Are you sure this is not The Bastard?
It's also called The Bastard.
Oh, okay. I've seen. Okay. This is with Gemma Hayworth. I think that was her last film. And Klaus Kinski. Yeah. Yeah,
that's one that has a good reputation.
I didn't know it was called The Cats. I had no idea.
Yeah,
that is an early Eurocrime film. It's from 68, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's an early one. It's in that early period where everything is kind of not as ridiculously violent as it would get in the 70s.
Yeah, I have the Warner Archive DVD, and it's under the title The Cats.
They used to stream it on Warner Archives, I remember. Mm-hmm. Like, back when that was an active channel you can subscribe to for like $5 a month or whatever.
The Bloodstained Butterfly, that's one I like quite a bit, with Helmut Berger.
Yeah, his two Delon films, The Zorro and I think it's called Big Guns, also Tony Arzetti, those were both released in mainland China during the Mao thing. Like, they were actually released in theaters across China. Like, The Zorro was so popular. Like, that was one of the first films from the West actually shown in China. And think about it, they didn't get Star Wars in the 70s, so they were pretty amazed by Zorro, which is a fun, really fun.
And both are Alain Delon.
Mm-hmm.
Big Guns, and yeah. Yeah, I forgot Tessari did that one. That's an enjoyable movie, too.
Yeah,
pretty good. And then, correct me, if you have his filmography up, did he do Mean... it's with Lee Van Cleef and Tony LoBianco and Edwidge Finch. Mean Frank and Crazy Tony, did he do this? I want to say
it was that
75, 74, somewhere in the middle.
Could
be confusing with somebody else.
Mean Frank and I see Tony
73.
Tony or Z?
No, I'm sorry. I got it.
That's Big Guns.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Michele Lupo is actually, I'm not surprised I got them confused. They're similar. They're similar directors. They both
did a movie with Isaac Hayes and Fred Williamson, Three Tough Guys.
Three Tough Guys. Yeah, I've
seen
that. Yeah.
Very rare film.
Yeah, hard to see. Yeah.
Yeah, Lino Ventura. Great Isaac Hayes score.
I didn't even know about the film until I went to Stax Records for the museum. They have a poster of it. I'm like, whoa, what's this movie? I've never heard of this blaxploitation movie. And then I looked at the credits. I was like, Duccio Tessari, what?
You know? Yeah.
Gotta watch it, but I still haven't. It's been like 7-8 years.
Yeah, it's a hard film to attain because it played on like Stars on like Encore channels back in the early 00s when they were just showing anything and everything from the 70s they get their hands on. You know, the good old days. But I remember it being a fun film. I did watch it once or twice.
Yeah, Fred is, from what I understand, Fred's the villain in it, right?
Yeah, he wears like this crazy leather pimp outfit. It's like, makes him look like a, it looks like something the Undertaker would wear in the WWF rings of the 90s, which is a really weird outfit. Like crazy big hat and everything. You can see it on the album, the soundtrack album cover. And Lino Ventura just looks like Lino Ventura, yeah, like in every film.
Sure, like in everything.
Yeah, wearing the Sears Roebuck suit and tie. Yeah, he plays like a tough priest. I think he plays like a priest too. Because the Isaac Hayes theme song describes the film. It's like preacher band, you know, black band, whatever. Right. They're tough guys.
But out of spaghetti Western directors, Tessari's up there.
Yeah,
especially once you get out of the Corbucci, the Leone, and the Salima realm.
Yeah,
he's pretty top tier.
I agree with that.
Yeah,
but his action is done in long takes. Is the interesting thing I noticed watching it this time with in the scope and everything. It's just one long take, and like Gemma is doing like a dozen things in like one take. It's pretty. Like yeah. There's a fight scene between him and the guy who attempts to rape the female lead. Yeah, it's such a wholesome film. There's an attempted rape scene. He's like gets into a fist fight with him, and it just goes on for a while. And there's some long takes of Gemma working his way around furniture and tumbling over, and then does it again in the shootout with Sancho in the finale.
Yeah, the fight. Oh, yeah, it is actually a good finale. He's toppling over furniture and stuff like that. But yeah, the fight doesn't get good till they go inside, because it starts outside and it's really bad. It's a typical Italian fist fight nonsense. But then once they're inside, it's a little bit more ferocious. They're throwing shit at each other, hatchets, they're throwing chickens at one point.
Yeah.
They miss punches and hit like a wine container. He goes through a wall at one point. That's fun.
Yep.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, kind of the ultimate Giuliano. Gemma's did excel at fist fights. Kind of the ultimate one that you should probably watch is one of the last spaghetti westerns from 1977, California. Mm-hmm. And it's the fist fights in that movie are so good, they actually end with a fist fight as opposed to a gunfight. And it's he smashes, like this one actor is like drinking a bottle of wine and Gemma punches through the wine bottle. It's in slow motion and they break through a brick wall. It's really nasty stuff.
Jeez, I gotta watch that
one. I recommend that. California. It's part of that Twilight spaghetti cycle, Kiyoma and Manaha.
Right. This sounds like it was his last hurrah at being like a acrobatic action hero.
Yeah, definitely. I forget if he does anything. I know the action in Silver Saddle actually is pretty good. As it turned out, Lucio Fulci is pretty good as an action director.
He directs great fight scenes. He's really good with fist fights.
Yeah.
He's very good with that.
I forget if Silver Saddle is after California. I want to say Silver Saddle is 1978, which pretty much makes it the last spaghetti Western. Anything after that is kind of post, because there wouldn't be another one still coming at you.
It's nostalgia. You're hitting nostalgia levels.
After that. Like Tex Lord of the Deep.
Right. That's a total nostalgia piece.
No.
Are there any other topics with Pistol for Ringo before we sign out?
I was afraid to revisit this. I think I already mentioned this, I suppose, so I won't mention it again. But it worked out, more or less.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't seen it since the Arrow Blu-ray came out, so it hasn't been that long. So I figured I'd still like it, and I did. But I think Return of Ringo is the one I need to go back to.
Yeah, watch that with a fresh set of eyes. I got to buy that set, actually. I hate that cover. God, it sucks.
That's awful. It has a reversible cover, though.
Oh, good, yeah.
With the original poster. I use that one.
Yeah, I got to get all their Italian Westerns just because, so I can throw away a lot of DVD-Rs. I have something close to 300 of those things, and I need I'm never going to watch most of them ever again.
Yeah, getting a Blu-ray of Massacre Time was very nice.
That is what sold me on that box. I was just like, because that I've never seen it any other way than what it looks like constantly.
Washed out.
Yeah, just
too bright. Yeah. Dirt transfer.
What's and God Said to Cain is in that, right? That's a good film.
Yep. Yep,
yeah, that's a good box set, except that Pecos movie, which I will revisit.
I haven't watched it, so I'm going to watch it.
Yeah, in fact, I told John when they announced it, I was just like, I'm going to watch a little bit of Massacre Time just to see what it looks like, and then I'm going to watch Pecos just to revisit that, see if that's gotten any better. And that's it. I'm going to put it on the shelf and never watch any of those movies, because I know the other two back-to-back. just like how my Django DVD is never going to be open, pretty much.
Well, John, what about you? Any other last thoughts?
I really like the Angel Face theme. It's one of the rare Ennio Morricone themes or soundtracks with vocals.
Yes.
I think it's the same guy who sang the theme. Bullets Don't Argue. I'm not sure, though. I didn't check the credits. But Angel Face, I heard it on a comp for years, not realizing it was also – I had also heard it on Ringo, the Pistol for Ringo, when I rented it years before. And so, but that, when I bought like the Ennio Morricone, the Italian Western soundtracks compilation RCA put out, that was one of the top tracks on there.
Well, let's go ahead and rate this thing. Eric, what would you give it out of 10?
7.
7?
Mm-hmm.
John, what about you?
I give it a 7. It was fun to revisit and great to see in scope.
I'd give it a 7 as well. I think the first time I watched it, I might've rated it like an 8.
Yes.
But it's a very good spaghetti Western. I think it's refreshing because it's a little different from a lot of them because it's so early on. So, yeah, I think if you, especially the Christmas theme gives it a unique flavor as well.
Did you rate it an 8 because you thought it was more realistic than the American Western you've been putting up with?
That was the only reason. No, I think I overrated it a little bit when I first saw it because it was different than other spaghetti Westerns from the time.
Yeah.
Well, and 10 years ago, I would have given this a 9.
Yeah. Oh, I think when I first saw it, I would have said it's one of the best spaghetti Westerns out there. But, you know, like with anything, you need to be careful because, you know, you got to come down a little bit. And
you have to. Yeah. I don't know what the consensus is for Giuliano Gemma now with among the, when I got into the game almost 20 years ago now, maybe more, the consensus was that nobody really liked Gemma because he was too clean cut, all the problems with, you know, all the myth and stuff. And I never had that issue at all with Gemma. I thought his choices in movies are really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think he has a bad movie, honestly.
No, he doesn't. There's no dogs.
Yeah. Maybe Alive, preferably Dead, because I don't really like that kind of, you know.
What about Hex? That movie sucks.
Oh, well, okay. But that's like, that. Yeah, that's a piece of shit. But it's post all this stuff.
Yeah, that's
later. Period. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, he had very good choice. In fact, out of the three guys, Franco, him, and Tomas, I would say he probably made the best choices. Mm-hmm. Blood on a Silver Dollar, I haven't seen it in many years, but I think it's pretty good. I would watch that too. That's an early one as well. But I've always liked him. I wonder if the tide has turned. I haven't been courageous enough to go check out what fellow Italian Western people think of it. Mm. Think of him. But that was between 2003 and at least to 2010. The consensus was that Gemma, you know, he's lightweight. You know, that's not what we want.
I kind of recall that none of them really liked him. They were very kind of down on him just because he's tall, broad-shouldered, acrobatic. He's like everything. None of the other guys really were. So
usually clean-shaven too.
Right, right, and he's. To me, he's sort of like a proto Terrence Hill. Like Terrence Hill later started doing acrobatics when he's doing the Trinity movies and everything. And to me, that's very inspired by Giuliano. So,
that's true. Well, so this is our last show for the year. So, Merry Christmas, everybody, and we'll catch you next year. We didn't take a break for Nez, so if there's a segment for that, Stu will put that at the end.
Yeah.
And we will go ahead and say adios.
Yeah, peace out.
Merry Christmas to all, and to all, well, good night.
Yep.
And now it's time for Rue Britannia with your foreign correspondent, the Nez.
This is your weekly briefing and you are most welcome to it. In a move that will surprise nobody other than fans of absolute beginners, the government was plunged back into scandal mode for Christmas this year by the revelation that it had broken the law on COVID adherence, not least last Christmas. The allegations center around a Christmas party, or, depending on which source you believe, Christmas parties at Downing Street, 4 days after the government effectively shut down the country last Christmas as a COVID prevention measure. Suffice to say, for what would have been for many last year their last Christmas was denied. This was the government party and broke its own laws. Though the Prime Minister has over the last 12 months denied the government broke the law persistently last Christmas, a video came conveniently showing Shirley's press spokesman boasting and laughing about the events in question was released this week to the press. In the course of 24 hours, she resigned. Shirley announced the review of the parties and denied again the fact that, frankly, the party or parties actually ever happened last Christmas. Lest we forget also that there was a police investigation into the affair, which of this week has been dropped. This, I suspect, will be his final Christmas in Downing Street. Any attempt by the government to restore any further lockdown measures to the English people this Christmas will be ignored. What little moral authority he retained has now gone. All of this, by the way, just in time for the Christmas by-election in Staffordshire North next week. The seat vacated by corrupt ex-Tory MP Owen Paterson now threatens a messy 5-week custard pie fight between the Tories, Labour, the Lib Dems, the Reform Party and the Reclaim Party. Indeed, Reclaim, headed by ex-actor Lawrence Fox, pulled off a stroke this week by announcing the defection of a Tory councillor. Quote unquote, it's a real key for the party, beamed Lotta, especially since there were so many people who looked down on me after Starving and the Inspector Moore spin-off. Well, they're not laughing now, whereas I'm smoking Cuban political cigars rolled under the semi-naked thighs of a 19-year-old virgin, he infused. Good for him. As a guess, a lower electoral turnout and a drastically reduced majority will ensure even further collateral damage for Shirley at Christmas. Even better. Meanwhile, the Sunday Times reports that drug abuse and usage, specifically cocaine, within the House of Commons is positively rife as endemic. Quite a surprise. Indeed, it appears that MPs' choice of location of usage is based around the toilets within the Palace of Westminster. Don't panic now, as Shirley was out with the police this week on a carefully staged, this timed, pre-planned 5 a.m. drugs raid in Liverpool to mark the government's new anti-drugs initiative, which includes proposals to remove passports and driving licences for those convicted for drug possession and usage. On that basis, no MP in the Commons will be travelling anywhere anytime soon. All of which is to say that the Conservatives are back in trouble, down in the polls, besieged at Christmas, and the approval ratings for Shirley and his Home Secretary in freefall. In short, a cynical and superficial attempt to reach out to the Tory base, and all completely firm. Meanwhile, the equally under siege BBC have gotten themselves into another right pickle after it was disclosed that the broadcaster invested over £150 million of licence fee payers' money into China in 2021 alone. Your BBC. Thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, it was accidentally discovered this week that the woke right-ons have invested in Chinese state-owned companies. This despite the fact that the BBC's China correspondent was expelled from the country this year. It gets even better, given how the companies are alleged to have committed human rights violations and abuses. This, in a way, confirms the BBC's woke CRGT hypocrisy, namely, publicly encouraging the idea of a black Doctor Who, whilst having been warned by China that the casting of a black actor in the role of Doctor Who will effectively result in Doctor Who being cancelled by Chinese state television, let alone anywhere else in the country. So I guess the idea of Idris Elba playing Bond was really more of a fabricated sham than we actually first assumed. Once upon a time, the BBC believed in the concept of nation shall speak peace unto nation. These days, they believe in the black one, the gay one, the brown one, the wheelchair one, the undecided one, the question mark one, the short horse one, the potato one, and the yellow one. Though the yellow one certainly above all others. And finally, the Prime Minister's wife, Seabiscuit, gave birth to her second child this week. Mother and child are doing well. Father, not really so much, surprising given that he's actually now fathered 7 children officially, though unofficially the figure is believed to be either side of 12. The child already has a name, Damien Thorn. He's up.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.